Our second case, second of four oral arguments. I'm joined by Chief Judge Frisch, Judge Chudich, myself, Judge Sleater, and I'll wait till counsel are closer, more counsel. Thank you. Our second case is file A241616, in re the estate of Tricia J. Ingersoll. We are recording these proceedings and live streaming, so we do ask counsel to identify yourself for the record when you begin your comments. No other recording is allowed except for pre-approval. Also, we do ask counsel to keep an eye on the clock as you see it there on the podium, and the podium has a button in front of the face of it to adjust it to your comfort level as well. And with that, I'll turn to counsel for appellant. You may approach, and when you're ready, identify yourself and begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning. I represent the appellant in this matter, Chad Offerman. Your Honors, the question...
Did you state your name? I'm sorry.
Oh, Attorney Amy R. Mason.
Very good. Thank you.
Can't follow instructions yet. The question for this court to determine is whether or not the trial court abused its discretion when it failed to consider the equitable relief that was in front of it. Specifically, whether a constructive trust was appropriate in the set of circumstances to avoid unjust enrichment of decedent's estranged husband, respondent Chad Ingersoll, through his inheritance of her entire estate. And I believe the answer is yes, that the trial court did abuse its discretion when it failed to analyze or even consider this requested relief.
Did it fail to consider the requested relief? I mean, the way that I read the district court's order is that it determined that the intestacy statute, which is part of the Uniform Probate Code, which is adopted in all 50 states, provides that the surviving spouse inherits the decedent's estate. And that seems to be dispositive. And we have 100-plus years of law in Minnesota and elsewhere that equity follows the law and that we don't depart from the law for equity's sake. So why is it that the district court abuses discretion in following clearly stated law in this case?
So, Your Honor, in fact, equity, from all the cases that I read, actually serves a different purpose. Equity is put in place to avoid absurd results, to avoid clearly unfair outcomes when that's what the law would lead to. And I
So your position is that we should completely disregard the statute, or that the court should have completely disregarded the statute?
So, Your Honor, I believe that that is the whole point of equitable remedies, and that's why the standard is so high, and that's why it has to be clear and convincing evidence in order for a court to step in and utilize its equitable powers.
Has there been a jurisdiction anywhere that has dispensed of the intestacy statute in favor of forming a constructive trust when there's a valid marriage?
So, Your Honor, there's...
I didn't see one. I didn't find one.
So I didn't search outside of Minnesota because that would not have been controlling the law. But what you find repeatedly with constructive trust cases is that they do deviate from the probate code. That has happened repeatedly. For example, you will have a valid will, and they will say, but that would be unjust to follow that will in this instance because it was clear that the testator's intentions and level of trust with this person would lead to an unfair result. So in those cases, you are not having to find that the will is invalid, right?
Those are situations where the testator has actually made an expression of intent. I mean, those are different than a situation where the testator has made no expression of intent, but could have made an expression of intent if the testator so chose.
So Your Honor,
how do we square that with the intestacy statute, which sets sort of a lockstep? This is how we're going to dispense of a we're going to dispose of an estate when the testator has made no expression of intent.
Certainly, Your Honor. So I, first of all, I would say that even when a testator makes an expression of intent outside of a will, nine times out of ten, that will stands because we honor wills, we honor contracts. So, but there is this window of opportunity that is open to the courts to invoke equitable remedies when it would be an incredibly unfair and unjust result. And so, and the laws on constructive trust make it very, very clear that there is not this five-part test. There is not this, and so you can look at the specific situation and each case to do justice, to evoke justice. And that's what I kept.
Isn't that what the district court did here, though? I mean, it seems to me like the district court's ruling is that applying the intestacy statute is appropriate under these circumstances, and alternatives are not appropriate under these circumstances.
So, Your Honor, she absolutely did not. The court did not do that. And what you find is repeatedly in that nine-page order is her saying, the only question in front of this court is whether or not they were legally married or whether or not they were legally divorced. And if you look at the conclusions of law, you see it. It's lockstep. Because they were legally married, this is the statute applies, and this is the outcome. You see it again in the findings of fact. She addresses it in paragraphs 19, 20, and 21. And once again, she says, the question in front of me is whether or not they were legally married. So she put on blinders, and she narrowed the scope. And it's my position that then she never should have allowed a five-day trial. There was no need for a five-day trial. She did not apply the facts. We had the majority of the witnesses, and she didn't even note any of their testimony. We had the text messages. We had all the evidence.
I mean, I don't read the district court's order as stridently as you do, counsel. Like, for example, in paragraph 20, the district court says the evidence is clear and convincing. Clear and convincing, that's pretty high. That decedent was aware she was legally married to the objector, that the objector was a beneficiary of one of her financial accounts, and if she were to die, all of her assets would go to objector as a surviving spouse. That's more than they're married, that's it. That's she knew what she was doing. She knew how her assets were going to pass.
So, Your Honor, she didn't even consider the question of was it unjust for him to receive it. She didn't even consider the fact that she was trusting in him to follow through with that divorce. The months that passed, she considered none of it. She didn't consider his credibility versus the credibility of our witnesses. This was a nine-page order that as much as she noted evidence in one paragraph, if you read the evidence from start to finish, she had a very narrow focus, and it was whether or not they were married. And a further evidence of that is you look at the one and only case that she cited to, which was Kuber. She didn't even consider constructive trust cases. She didn't cite to a single one. She cited to one case, and it was Kuber. And even Kuber disagreed with the district court's determination that equitable remedies were not appropriate. Even Kuber said, in this case, the doctrine of equitable estoppel is not appropriate because in this case, the person who prevailed under the law was also the person that would have prevailed under equity. So she didn't even consider that piece of it. She just said, I have to do this because of this statute. And that's where that didn't require a trial. Never once did we challenge whether or not they were still legally married.
Counsel, getting to the merits of constructive trust, and this goes back to the law and equity, it does seem like the legal issue did have to be addressed first. For the reasons you were discussing with the chief, it seemed like you first resolved that. But in any event, even if we get to the constructive trust, how, as a matter of law, once the court found that they were legally married and spouse, and therefore, pursuant to the intestacy statute, has a right to the property, versus when you look at constructive trust cases in law, it only becomes unjust because of a fact that the possessor knew it was he or she was possessing property for someone else. But here, obviously, as a matter of law, he's the surviving spouse and has a right pursuant to law to have to possess that, to inherit the property. So how would you ever, even if there were more findings that get your point about that directly to it, would you ever get past a conclusion that it can't be unjust because you're a spouse?
Certainly, Your Honor. So what happened in this case is that when respondent left, initially he was in a very big hurry to get divorced. And at some point he slowed way down on it. And my belief is that he understood, he learned through the process of going through the divorce and filling out the paperwork, that because 100% of her estate was inheritance, he would not in fact be entitled to any of it if in fact they divorced. And so she had made it clear, decedent had made it clear to her family that she did not want him to inherit, that she wanted either her brother or her niece to inherit. And so
she could have done something about that if she wanted to, right?
Yes, Your Honor. However, in this case, she was very disabled, and she had been in a tragic accident a couple years before, and there was extensive testimony and text messages that evidenced how respondent knew that she was going to die if she continued down the road that she was on. And she trusted respondent to take care of this. She had signed the paperwork. One of her aunts had seen it in her home, and respondent had informed her that the first time they had filled it out wrong, but that he was going to then file it with the court. And so she was relying on that representation. Additionally, she couldn't drive. By the end of her life, the last Thanksgiving she attended.
I appreciate the complicated underlying circumstances of the parties' relationships. The thing that I think is missing here, if we're looking at the facts, which I'm not sure we need to, but when looking at the facts, is that I don't see any improper conduct by the objector. I don't see his conduct as being improper. What did he do that was improper?
Your Honor, he misled her. He told her, I am taking care of this. He went to her house.
I am taking care of this, meaning taking care of what?
The divorce. He went to her house with the divorce papers. She was letting him do it in part because she, short-sightedly, but she thought, I will save money. Whoever files first has to pay. He has told me he is handling it. He came to my house on Easter. Her ex-boyfriend testified how she called him so excited that he had just left after taking the papers that she had signed. And so...
So his improper behavior is not following through with it?
Your Honor, when he did it intentionally, understanding that she was an alcoholic, and so telling someone you're going to do something, misleading them that you're taking care of something and that it's being handled... And, Your Honor, in this case, was she lower functioning than certainly everyone here? Yes, she was. But when you look at cases that deal with, hey, was someone unduly influenced, for example, the susceptibility of the person is an important consideration. So it is specific to that person. And it is our position that he understood exactly what he was doing. He knew about the inheritance. In fact, he left relatively shortly after she started getting the inheritance, and then wasn't in a hurry to get a divorce.
Wasn't there also evidence in the record, though, that she was more capable than it seemed? And the referee heard that evidence and made a decision that we had referred to about how she knew this, she knew that. Can we overturn that kind of factual finding?
So,
without defining that it's clearly erroneous.
So, Your Honor, obviously I base my appeal on her failure to really address the issues at all. There was, in my opinion, overwhelming evidence as to her limitations and where she was operating at. She did not work. She did not drive. She could not use her hand. By the end, she could not even walk. She literally had to be carried, and she scooted along. So if she had, in fact, addressed it, if she, in fact, said in here, I am analyzing constructive trust law, I am analyzing unjust enrichment, and whether or not this person has been unfairly and unjustly enriched, then I think that would have been a different appeal. And it would have been a question of, did she consider all the facts in a way that was not clearly erroneous? But in this case, she never got there. She never, to let us go through a five-day trial and the whole time being saying, her question was, do you have evidence of them getting divorced? I mean, she made it clear to us, actually, at some point halfway through the trial, and that was very concerning to me when she made that statement.
She made it clear before the trial that there were genuine issues of material fact as to the status of the party's marriage, and the intention of the trial was to determine the status of the party's marriage.
But, Your Honor, that's not what was in front of her, and that's not what either of the parties were presenting to her, and we kept trying to present it to her.
You can finish your answer.
Oh, thank you. We kept trying to present to her in no uncertain terms. If you look at both written closing arguments, both sides extensively briefed unjust enrichment and constructive trust, and all of that just went ignored by the court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, and you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. Counsel for respondent, you may approach, and when ready, identify yourself and begin.
Yes, good morning, Your Honors. My name is Matthew D. McDougall. I'm the attorney here on behalf of Respondent Chad Ingersoll. So, as Ms. Mason noted, appellant's sole issue on appeal is whether the district court wholly failed to consider its request for equitable relief. And with a rational reading of the court's order, which was filed August 13, 2024, the only answer that can be logically reached is the court did consider that equitable relief. Paragraph 19 itself of that order specifically references the requested relief under a constructive trust theory, and the court finds that that argument was unpersuasive. In the reply to the respondent's brief, appellant indicates that his theory of the case was that the respondent misled the decedent, that the decedent believed that he was handling the divorce, but also on page 7 she says that the decedent was depending on the respondent to effectuate the divorce. So if you go back and look at the findings of fact section of this order, you see that approximately 12 of those findings of fact have nothing to do with the marital status of the decedent and the respondent. Essentially, if you look to paragraph 10C, no medical evidence was introduced at trial related to the decedent's physical health or mental capacity that would have prevented either the decedent or objector from pursuing dissolution of the marriage. Again, this is not a marital status question. This is a finding of fact that if the decedent was intended to be dependent on the respondent, here's an evidence that showing that that wasn't reasonable. There was no evidence in the record that she was physically or mentally diminished to a capacity that she could not do this herself. Paragraph 10D states that the decedent and objector had ample time and ability to terminate the marriage prior to her death. Again, this is not a finding specific as to the relationship status. This is showing that the decedent had the ample opportunity and ability to do this herself.
Counsel, would you concede, however, at a minimum, the court didn't do what we might describe as a traditional legal analysis of the elements of constructive trust in the conclusions of law or tie those findings into it. Instead, your point, or even perhaps analyzed whether equitable relief was appropriate here at all, given the legal sufficient legal resolution, that being the marriage, still married, and in other words, follow up with that, therefore I won't analyze it because equity follows the law and the law has answered the question. So in that sense, what you're asking us to do, I think, is to interpret some of that kind of analysis without the referee actually diving in that way, in that more direct way.
It is true, Your Honor, that the court did not specifically in its conclusions of law address the constructive trust argument. However, the court did find expressly that that argument was unpersuasive, and in doing so, relies on all these findings of fact, including those in paragraphs 19 and 20. You know, respondent argues that the Cooper case is cited and relied upon solely as being dispositive on whether marriage precludes any other finding and therefore disposes of the unjust enrich, or I'm sorry, the constructive trust claim. That's not what the court is doing. As noted by this court, the Cooper case was relied upon as an example of the level of gravity that the courts of this jurisdiction place on a marriage itself. In that case, there was a 20-year period during which a wife thought she was divorced. She had remarried. She only found out that the divorce had not been effectuated after the husband's death, and the court simply said, yeah, you're married, you get it. She got her spousal elective share. The court didn't follow that analysis by saying, you're married, you're done. As this court noted, it proceeded to say, clear and convincing evidence provides that the decedent was aware of the fact that she was married. Not that she was married. She was aware of the fact that the respondent was a beneficiary on one of her financial accounts. She was aware of the fact that if she were to die, he were to get it all. Again, this is not a simple analysis of they're married, that's the end of it.
I wonder if that is all it is, I mean, or all it needs to be, because the district court has determined that your client is an eligible surviving spouse. The intestacy statute clearly provides for the line of succession in that situation. Is there an equitable option when equity follows the law and the law clearly dictates a result upon a finding that there is an eligible surviving spouse in an intestacy situation? Is there ever a possibility for a constructive trust under those circumstances or an unjust enrichment claim under those circumstances? I'm not sure that there is.
And I'm honestly not sure of that answer either, Your Honor. What I can tell you here is that this court did consider this equitable remedy. So regardless of what is being argued today before this court that it was not considered, it was. So regardless of whether that equitable remedy should have been or could have been applied, it was considered and it was found unpersuasive. And the court has ultimately ruled as a matter of law that this matter should proceed as the court found.
Yeah.
Your client never argued that unjust enrichment did not apply in this situation or a constructive.
The specific arguments, Your Honor, that were forwarded by my client was the fact that the statute provided the remedy. The statute provided the guidance. The probate code stated that as a surviving spouse, when the decedent died intestate with no descendants, he was entitled to be the sole heir of her estate and had priority to serve as a personal representative.
But did you engage with the constructive trust argument? You didn't make the argument that I understand that the chief is making now, that you simply can't have that when the intestacy statute applies.
We did make the argument to the extent that it's a policy argument, that essentially the reason that probate code exists is to provide clarity and some form of expectation as to what happens when somebody dies without a will. So we certainly did engage in responding to the equitable claims that were forwarded by appellant, but it was not in any way, shape, or form a waiver of our position on the matter.
And as I understand it, the probate code does have specific references to equitable remedies in it.
Well, in terms of the matter at hand before the court, the only exception that is specifically enumerated in the probate code for when a decedent, when the respondent wouldn't be entitled to her assets would be if he intentionally and feloniously killed her, which in no way, shape, or form was an issue before the court. So that's the one exception to the probate code that I'm aware of and can speak to today.
I guess I was talking more generally about provisions allowing for equitable relief under the probate code.
Without a specific example, I'm not sure if there's a provision in the probate code that contemplates an equitable relief in the situation in which we find ourselves. As again, it relates to the court's order, it analyzed the appellant's claims, looked into that, and determined they were unpersuasive.
Yeah.
In your research, counsel, did you find any cases applying a constructive trust in an intestacy situation?
Outside of the cases that appellant forwarded and those that we responded with, I did not find any case law where a spouse was disinherited pursuant to a constructive trust theory. Any other questions from the courts?
Don't appear to be any.
Okay. Just in summary, Your Honors, we would request that the district court's decision be affirmed and the appeal be denied. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And counsel for appellant, you now will have 5 minutes, so you may approach, and when you're ready, you may begin.
Thank you. So we have a long history in Minnesota of equitable remedies being allowed. And in Swager v. Taylor, the court said, equity functions as a supplement to the rest of the law where its remedies are inadequate to do complete justice.
Where the remedies are inadequate to do complete justice. Why isn't the intestacy statute adequate to do complete justice?
Because, Your Honor, it's our position that respondent has been unjustly enriched in this situation because for 2 years, after leaving his wife to be with another woman, for 2 years, he led her on to believe that he was moving forward with divorcing them. He led her on, and she trusted in that. And really, Your Honor, the question is not her ability to go and get a divorce in a different way. Is that a consideration? Sure. But the question with unjust enrichment is whether or not respondent was unjustly enriched.
I feel as though, counsel, you're asking us to craft an exception to the intestacy statute that does not exist, and that is something that should be left to the legislature. We have a uniform probate code. It is adopted in all 50 states. There is an exception. The Slayer statute is the exception to the intestacy statute, and help me understand why what you're advocating for is not just another form of an exception to clearly established law.
So, Your Honor, in the years that I've spent with this case, it's been my understanding in reviewing all of the cases that how the judicial branch works as a whole is that courts have the ability to effect complete justice. And when the law, which has its lane, results in an absurd or completely unfair, inequitable result, the court's hands are not tied. They have the ability to do what's right and just. And that is the role of equity. And that's why the standard is clear and convincing. Because, no, we don't want every time a situation arises for people to be able to run in. And that's why the standard is clear and convincing when you try to undo a will or a deed. And so it's a very high bar. But absolutely, the courts have the ability to act in that way. Rosenberg's in a Minnesota 2004 case, statutes in derogation of an equitable remedy are to be strictly construed to not supplant, impair, or restrict equity's normal function as an aid to complete justice. And, Your Honor, if you look at the Spice case, which was the Minnesota Court of Appeals case in 1989, in that case, they specifically looked at the fact that there was a statute that controlled, and it was a probate statute. It was Minnesota Statute 528.05, and that is for payable and death accounts. But the court said that in this case, they were going to create a constructive trust. So even though that statute specifically says this is how things are inherited, this is who gets this under a pay. If it says your name as the beneficiary, you get it. But in that case, they said that, nope, we're going to allow the creation of a constructive trust to avoid unjust enrichment. And the court went on to say that even though the payable on death statute did not specifically allow for equitable reliefs, it also did not preclude it. The court reasoned that it would be morally wrong to ignore the clear and convincing evidence of decedent's intent and the beneficiary's unjust enrichment. And in this case, decedent did not want respondent to inherit her assets. And respondent, by misleading her, actively misleading her, ended up in an unjust result. And from day one, this case has not been fairly handled. Our ability to access discovery was hampered early in. Respondent never submitted any text messages. He never submitted emails. He never submitted anything to
I appreciate that, counsel. Those are not on those issues are not on appeal, are they?
No, Your Honor. But when we're talking about whether or not there was unjust enrichment, the court could have looked at the credibility, the lack of evidence, and that's where I'm saying that if she, in fact, had head-on addressed, has he been unjustly enriched, many of those facts could have come to life. But it's clear to me that she didn't want to consider those things. She stopped at the statute. She did not look past it.
Very well. Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. Thank you to both counsel for your answers to our questions and your briefing. We will now take the matter under advisement, issue an order within 90 days.
Thank you.
You have a good day.